colleague.
Good morning. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee for on Judiciary. Today we have some measures for possible introduction, and so I'm going to open up a work session for taking in those measures. And Council, could you tell us what we have on the LC possible introduction for measures?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for measure introduction today, we have LC 3172, LC 3375, and LC 3520.
All right, and
I thought she said 23. But it's just 20, isn't it?
3172, 3375, and 3520 are the three
20.
LCs
okay.
For introduction today.
Yeah. So could the chair get a motion on those, and I'll make the our caveat statement afterwards.
I'll make the motion and then make a comment. Mr. Chair, I move LC 3172 dated 1/26/11, LC 3375 dated 1/28/11, and LC 3520 dated 1/19/11 be introduced as committee bills.
And to your motion, well, let me go ahead. Senator Cruz makes the motion for possible for introduction of the following three LCs: LC 3172, LC 3375, and LC 3520. Before you make your comments, this is just our standard boilerplate language for these type of introductions. This does not mean that individual members who would support the motion support the bill or the context of the bill itself. It's just a process to allow for the bills to be introduced as committee bills and to be assigned by the president to whatever committee they may go to, whether or not any of us are going to support them if they should come out to the floor for a vote. It's not we are not bound by our vote today for that.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I just say that it would be my hope that none of these bills ever get a hearing at any point in time during this session.
All right. Thank you for your comments. Any others? Senator Wissett.
I think that this group of bills is probably symptomatic of what is the problem with introducing committee bills in general. I would agree with Senator Cruz that we would hope that these bills never see the light of day, but this process allows bills like these to be introduced into a committee without anybody taking any responsibility for drafting or introducing the bill. And I think that is one of the fundamental flaws that we have in our current legislative process. I personally would love to see a Senate rule or a legislative rule that requires that anyone who has a bill drafted at least has their name on it for the ownership of the of having it drafted.
I would say in response that at least one of these three does have at the request of, which is the 3520. The other two, I would assume that whoever brought them to the committee staff for possible introduction, there's some notation as to where that's at, and so there should be some type of paper trail. But I will say that this is a process that we've used in the legislature to allow individuals or groups to have an opportunity to have their concepts, one, drafted, and two, put into the process. And as we all know, none of us are bound by a vote today to accept those as committee bills. And then if we want to have that discussion of, as to what should or shouldn't be allowed or permitted as committee bills, I would say let's take it to the guy at the higher pay level. I think it's president.
Yeah, just Mr. Chair. my example of the horse bill that went viral on us, one of the comments I have heard over and over, both from media and from constituents, is, whose bill is it? And I say, it's a committee bill. There's no name on it. And I think that causes some angst in the public, which, by the way, they're faith in us is not all that wonderful at this point in time, and I think that's one of the, on what Senator Whitsitt's talking about, that's one of the things that does not help with our public image is when we can have things with where nobody's responsible, and to a degree, that's the system we've got.
All right. Any other comments? All right. With that, any objections to the motion? Not seeing or hearing any, so passed, and those will become committee bills to be referred to the president for his introduction as well as assignment to whatever committee, if any committee. All right, so that takes care of that. So what we have, also we had left open, and so I'll close the work session on the possible measure introductions, and we had left open a couple of things. First, the public hearing and possible work session on the Senate Bill 353. It was supposed to have been noted for just possible work session, but since it does say public hearing, I'm going to ask if there's anyone here in the audience today who made a trip here today who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 353. Not seeing anyone raising their hands or running up to the dais, we'll go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 353.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 353 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 353 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. To your motion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for allowing me a day to look into some things. Elsie was very helpful in explaining things to me. I do find it interesting that we had a bill that was passed last session to create a task force and a sub-account, and the sub-account was never created. So based on that, eliminating a sub-account that was never created seems to be a reasonable thing to do. So I'm satisfied with all aspects of the bill at this point.
They say, you know, in the field of justice, the wheels move slowly, I think maybe a little slower in the legislative branch at times, yeah. Or in the executive branch once the legislature has done
right.
Their part. So with that, any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And so then we will need a carrier on 353. And it seems to me that since one of our colleagues hasn't been able to get here at the appropriate time, that Senator Dingfelder will be our carrier for Senate Bill 353.
Actions have consequences, don't they?
All right, and then let's see. So we've closed the work session on 353, and we're going to go ahead and reopen for the limited purpose of taking testimony on Senate Bill 77. Andrea, I understand that you're back. Thank you very much, LC. And Andrea, just to let you know, we've received your material. I believe everyone has had an opportunity to go through that. But we did want to give you an opportunity, since you had travel plans that did not allow you to be here yesterday, to take a small amount of time to kind of emphasize your points. And before you do that, I do want to recognize we do have a new counsel here, Drew Johnson. Drew, thank you very much for being part of our process. And we all look forward to working with you during the session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 77 requires inmates to exhaust administrative procedures before bringing claims, and also makes various limits on places various limits on inmates' ability to file small claims. And I would like to also note that yesterday the committee received a letter from Pro Tem Judge Terry Leggert, and that should be on file as well. So.
Yes. Before Andrea gets started, I'd just like to say to Drew that it's going to be a pleasure working with you. Your father was a good friend and colleague. We worked on a lot of things together, and it was an honor to know him.
Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. First, thank you so much for keeping the hearing open and allowing me the privilege to speak on this issue. It is an important issue for the ACLU of Oregon. I will try to be brief. I'm not reading my testimony, but I do have some points I'd like to try to make as I go through this. And I do appreciate the fact that hopefully you've all reviewed the issues. Obviously, I'm here in opposition to Senate Bill 77 because a good chunk of it replicates the Federal Prison Litigation Reform Act exhaustion requirement. The main purpose of that requirement was to get federal courts out of running state prisons and jails, and it was never really intended to limit a prisoner's access to remedies in state court. Section 2, bars an inmate from bringing any action against the public body unless the inmate has exhausted all administrative remedies. Has my microphone... Okay, it's going in now. I just want to make sure people can hear me, if that's necessary.
And most importantly, the microphone's working to capture your tape, your voice on tape.
Absolutely, great.
It does cut in and out here, so
okay,
don't worry about
that. I tend to project if I'm not using a microphone. So Section 2 bars an inmate from bringing any action against the public body unless the inmate has exhausted all administrative remedies provided by DOC. And this is a fundamental policy change affecting basic access to justice. It bars an inmate from seeking relief in courts for fundamental violations of their rights during incarceration unless they fully exhaust the procedures. You know, DOC's grievance procedures are set up to manage inmates' ability to grieve, and while it may be a completely appropriate process for grievance when it is linked to fundamental right to access to court, it creates unjustifiable barriers. I'm not sure you received yesterday, but in case not, I've submitted a copy today of a letter from Jeannie Woodford. She's the former warden of San Quentin State Prison and former director of California Departments of Correction, and Chase Rivland, who is the former secretary of the Washington State Department of Corrections and the former executive director of the Colorado Department of Corrections.
And we did receive that letter yesterday along with your testimony.
Great. Great.
And so the only one that we haven't received, it may be on electronic file, is the one that you mentioned this morning that came in from a pro tem judge.
Great. And I do have a copy of that, but thank you. I want to direct your attention to look at that. They urge that you do not go down this road, and hearing from folks who run institutions across this country and have the perspective of exhaustion requirements and their restrictions and good, sort of, for lack of a better word, good governance in a corrections facility, we believe is vital to the issue at hand. I've also, Congress created the National Prison Rape Elimination Commission, and I believe I quoted in my testimony a statement from them from about 3 years ago urging reform to the exhaustion requirements because, in particular, it has provided significant barriers to victims of sexual assault within the institutions to meaningfully seek relief for many reasons, including emotional trauma and so on, and that this grievance process makes insurmountable barriers. The DOC grievance procedures are set forth in administrative rule. Again, in short, they establish very limited timelines and procedural barriers for inmates to comply with grievance procedures. Just briefly, you must grieve within 30 days of the event. You may only raise one issue in a complaint. That's already a huge barrier to the most vulnerable of inmates, from mental capabilities, fear of retaliation, emotional trauma from the events, medical crisis, language skills, and solitary confinement, to name a few. The only exception to that is another inmate may file on behalf of one inmate, but it still is within the timeline, and the grieving inmates must be able to sign. There's no extension for deadlines. If the right form is not used, the grievance may be rejected. Unable to properly file, an inmate will be barred from further action, and we can see that they would never actually be able to exhaust the administrative remedies to comply with Section 2 to proceed with court. An inmate cannot expand on the grievance with new evidence or information unless it was unavailable at the time of filing, and we can expect the state to argue in court that the issues raised by the inmate was not brought before the agency properly, and so the case should be dismissed. While DOC does have some timelines and deadlines for response, those deadlines can be changed, and there's no time set for final resolution in the three-step grievance process. Again, I want to reiterate, this flexibility is probably important and appropriate to have in an administrative process. Hard and fast deadlines would be difficult, but to use that to link the ability to access courts raises significant problems. Inmates, if they do not grieve or have a procedural error in their filing of their grievance, the rules are silent on whether or not that 30 days is told or not. The we believe also this will create actually a whole new area of litigation rather than reducing litigation, because as we've seen in the federal PLRA, there's a whole area of litigation around exhaustion and whether the inmate's actually exhausted. Let's get to the merits of the issues and give relief when appropriate. The concern is, too, you're setting up a very structure of the people who run the institution, the people likely to be the ones subject to any litigation, are the ones controlling the timelines, the process, and that just is not the way we should be operating our systems. The results have been, in the federal PLRA, failure to exhaust and significant problems. I did not attach to my testimony. It was just too long, but I have a 2009 Human Rights Watch report specifically on the federal PLRA and the exhaustion requirements and the complete failure and the fundamental human rights violations that they identified. And the American Bar Association 2007 resolution urged governments at all levels to ensure that inmates have meaningful access to courts, and specifically calling for reforms to the exhaustion requirements. Now, we have extensive documentation that the federal PLRA does not reduce frivolous litigation, but instead removes access to courts by people with meritorious claims, and we should not replicate that model here. Right. The small claims.
I'm going to need you to wrap up, because we've got a presentation that's already over.
I'm sorry. I apologize. And I do.
You have time to meet with the members and talk to them individually as well.
Let me summarize on the issue around the small claims that was brought forward. If there are issues or problems with small claims and inmates using it, then there is an issue and a problem with small claims, period, because there are many vulnerable people out there who could be subject to that who are not inmates. Any of us could do any kind of action against another. If there is a problem, it needs to be globally fixed. What we're doing is also removing any rights of the ability of the inmate who is truly a victim, the vulnerable inmate, to seek remedies, and it's putting such procedural barriers that seems not to reduce the ability of the inmate that's discussed who wants to go after another inmate, but actually simply eliminate the ability for the inmate who rightly has an action against a government body to bring forth. I will skip everything else. I will say that I noted at the end, so Mr. Van Valkenburg doesn't need to get up here. I did note at the end of my testimony some possible constitutional issues. I haven't had the time to further research them since this bill was, similar legislation was brought forward 6 years ago. As I wrote in my testimony, it may implicate. So to be clear, I did not make a definitive statement, and I will be looking at the opportunities to evaluate that in more detail. But for us, it's a larger policy issue on both the general principle of exhaustion as well as the small claims. So I urge you not to move forward with this and appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And we're not planning on moving the bill at this point anyway. I'll give you some time to actually meet with members, and also if you want to meet with the Department of Corrections and see what, if anything, might be able to work out from that perspective of discussions. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very again for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
So at this point, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 353 and 77. And that will take care of that one. And then, so what we're going to do at this point, we're going to shift into an informational meeting. And I just want to make sure, before we do that, I'm going to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 353 for the purpose of allowing Senator Dingfelder to cast her vote, since we've already voted and you will be the carrier of that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late. I had a personnel issue I had to deal with this morning. I will vote aye.
All right. And so Senator Dingfelder votes aye on 353. I close the work session on 353. And now we're going to go into our informational meeting. And Max, you and Michael's here. Is Craig going to? So I'm not sure who's going to be all participating.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Max Williams. I'm the director of the Department of Corrections. And Anola is going to bring up my presentation here for me. I think I'm going to present first, and then Mr. Prinz is going to present following me. All right. Several of you have seen some or portions of this presentation before, so I'll do my best to expedite my way through it to conserve the committee's time. But Mr. Taylor had invited us, myself and Mr. Prinz, to go over some of the information that we had presented recently at a conference in Multnomah County. And the presentation that I'm sharing with you today is one that over the last probably 6 months or so I presented to numerous groups and organizations around the state in follow-up to Governor Kulongoski's reset report document that was issued it was June of last year, July of last year on the first version, and then the sort of reset 2.0 issued, I think, sometime in early December, right prior to the end of his administration.
Max, one of the reasons I wanted you to come back or come before the committee is I know Senator Cruz was not at that meeting. I know Senator Dingfelder was not. And since some of the issues that we'll be working on, I think, really fold right into your presentation, I thought it was imperative for the committee to either get a refreshener or a perspective, so then if they have other questions, they can come to you and to Mr. Prinz and get greater detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the opportunity actually to sort of begin, I think, at sort of a framework discussion for what I'm confident will be discussions we'll have to have this session about a variety of issues. I don't quite know how to make that.
If you put the cursor up there on that X, I think you can.
Will that
take
go away
that?
If I click
on
it?
Yeah. Lights, it's sort of hard to see. Please.
All right, and then I come down here and.
So this
really is just a beginning of, I put this slide in here to demonstrate that the challenges that we're dealing with in Oregon with respect to not only our total budget issue, but particularly the corrections budget, are we're not alone or isolated. This is a consistent issue across the states nationally, and I'm sure from your organizations that you participate in nationally, you've heard much of the same thing. From 85 to 2010, as you can see, nationally, the aggregate state prison population has increased by more than 200%. State correction spending went up by 674% across the states during that time frame. Our budget since 1989 at the Department of Corrections has increased by more than 500%. And then in 2010, just to give you some perspective of all of the states collectively, we weren't alone, as we know. All the states collectively were facing almost a $200 billion budget gap. This, again, is not information you're unfamiliar with. In Oregon, we have a $3.5 billion shortfall coming into this biennium, depending on how you count it. And some would say it's bigger than that if you don't count some of the numbers, and some might say it's more narrow than that. We used, for purposes of the reset, and everything I'm going to really talk about here is information as a member of Governor Kulongoski's reset cabinet that we were asked to do and prepare and work with. So this is from the reset cabinet's estimate of what that shortfall was going to be in the 11-13 biennium. Well, that's 20% of the state's general fund, and to give you a sense from a public safety standpoint, you could eliminate the budgets for all the public safety agencies and the judicial department, and you'd still be $700 million short of trying to balance the budget just out of the public safety share of the pie. So I think that just gives some sort of a sense of how deep our problems are with respect to the state's budget. The reset cabinet really took some time early in its beginning to talk about the things that we thought were key pieces of what state government was supposed to do. The charge was to really look at ways to sort of hone us back to our fundamental functions. And so we spent some time talking about core functions. And as you can see, these core functions, and I won't read them to you, are, I think, what most of us would probably agree are the fundamental reasons that we have a government. And at the top of that list, obviously, is keeping us safe in our homes and our communities. But it includes education. It includes helping the most needy in our society. It includes protecting us from the spread of disease. And you know, if you really net it out, that's what we really are talking about. Now, the thing that when I talk to groups, and obviously not you guys, and you, I'm sure, do all of this yourself when you're out talking to the Rotary Club or anybody else about these issues, you can get everybody to agree that that's where government ought to be investing its resources. And then you can show them this slide, like I do, and say, and that's in fact where 93% of our current money is being spent. in these very core functions that we've just talked about. The public safety and judicial branch are the smallest of the big three pieces of those investments, but they're still big, obviously. It's schools, it's human services, and it's public safety. And that little 7% that's left is a category of other things that generally we would all agree still are necessary at some level from an investment in state government, from transportation to economic development to even the funds necessary to run the legislative branch. So here's a picture of the budget detail more associated with public safety. And this is, again, the 9/11 budget frame. DOC's budget, as it was produced, reflected 67.2% of all statewide public safety spending, meaning state government, not including investments by local governments or counties. But you can see we're the big kahuna of the major public safety agencies. If you take the 20% on parole and post-prison supervision, the community corrections money, now recognize that passes through the Department of Corrections budget out to counties, but we broke that out separately so you could see its size and impact as compared to state police, the youth authority, and then the smaller justice agencies that are included there. Again, budget growth for the Department of Corrections is driven primarily by two primary components, and that's sentencing policy, and it's also personnel cost. Because we're in a people business, what we do takes people to do it, and that's a significant part of our piece. You've all seen this chart before. This is the chart that reflects the, based on the December 2010 revenue forecast, our expenditures versus our revenues projected for the rest of the decade. And as you can see, without some kind of a fundamental shift in how we do business, there's not a point at which our revenues and our expenditures meet. And there's been a lot of economic modeling that I won't bore you with that we did as part of the recent cabinet that shows that even if we had 4 years or 6 years of incredible growth, the best bienniums that we've ever experienced in state government, we would still not actually make these lines connect without some fundamental changes. So what we know is it's not just a revenue problem. We know there is more revenue this biennium, and that's been talked about here in the last couple of days, but we also know that our projected expenditures, given the way we deliver services as a state, outstrip our ability to meet those revenue projections. So we've got both a spending, a structure, and a prioritization problem as we deal with this issue. The reset recommendations really came in what I would say are probably five primary categories. These four major categories, K-12, higher education, human services, and public safety, all had a separate subcommittee that worked to develop sets of recommendations. The full cabinet also made specific recommendations around a variety of statewide issues, primarily as it related to compensation, benefit issues, and some general consolidation of services and different ways to approach service delivery that were done at the full cabinet level. Each of the four categories identified in this slide all issued separate reports that were attached in an addendum to the statewide report. So on some of these statewide initiatives that I'll just take a moment to cover, there were recommendations about trying to tie labor costs generally more to the private sector, to modify PERS, recommendations on the adjustment of the pickup, insurance cost sharing, and similar kinds of recommendations. There were recommendations around organization and efficiency issues to try to adopt more through statewide practices the lean initiative standards that a number of agencies are using. There were recommendations about revenue stability and kicker reform, and then obviously looking differently at how we might use state and local partnerships, looking at the consolidation possibilities, looking at changing the structures that we currently have in place for service delivery that might make more sense than some of the calcified structures we have now in the way we deliver services. The state hands money to the counties hand money to, and considering is there a different way to do that model that would be more efficient and effective in delivering services. Mr. Prinz will get into this in much more detail, but it's also, I think, important, particularly as we move to the public safety process and thinking about these issues, that we acknowledge that Oregon is in a unique place, I think, to have this conversation, different than maybe we were certainly a decade ago. We are at the lowest crime rate in both violent crime and property crime that Oregon has been in since the 1960s. And so it's important, I think, to also acknowledge that we've seen the benefit, I think, of a consistent investment in public safety, certainly from local law enforcement through, you know, county prosecutors, through our judges, the court system, our jail operations, and I think our investment in treatment and addiction recovery, our efforts around reentry and transition back to the community. I think all of those things have had a positive impact on our public safety system. Similarly, in property crime, we're the lowest we've been since 1966, and the first time that we've been below the U.S. average since we started collecting this data in 1960. So, again, I think it's also important not to overstate the policy implications that we've had with respect to these issues. There's a lot of reasons that crime rates rise and fall, and what Mr. Prinz will also share with you is nationally, those crime rates have fallen pretty much across the country. And some of that's driven by demographics, some of that's driven by policy, and I think it's difficult to exactly identify and pull out which piece is which. But we certainly are at a point where we've got lower crime on a per capita basis in Oregon than we have for decades, and I think that's again gives us sort of this appropriate time to talk about whether there are strategies that would allow us to do things potentially differently than we're doing them now. I always include this slide particularly because we're the biggest piece of the state public safety budget. I include this little thing called the budget box for DOC because I think it's helpful for people to understand. We are sometimes referred to as the black hole on the public safety budget, and I think that really is a reference to the limitations, I think, that we've put in place collectively as a state that make it difficult sometimes to do what others might want to do inside the Department of Corrections budget. On the one hand, we're fairly well restrained by sentencing policies. Policies that require no releases, mandatory sentences, and changes to those policies, which require a two-thirds vote by the legislature to make different constitutional measures that require, if anything's applied retroactively, that there's a fairly complicated rehearing process. On the other side, as you well know, Oregon has a collective bargaining process, and we have unions that we work with closely who represent our employees, and those are bargained relationships. And those contracts have the effect of law, and we enforce those contracts, and they drive some costs as well. We have issues around bargaining safety issues that are a function of a recently passed Senate Bill 400 and other actions that have an impact on that side of our equation. The fiscal constraints obviously come from the pressure that the state's under, along with things like commitments that are made to how we're going to fund or deal with PERS, to decisions by the legislature to not update our operating costs in certain categories, and then the community corrections actions where we have to avoid or have attempted, at least as a matter of policy, to avoid counties opting out. And then finally, on the bottom of that box, you've got the constitutional and statutory constraints, the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which provides that we make sure that the conditions of confinement meet constitutional standards. And we are regularly in litigation around those standards because that is the nature of what happens when you are in charge of an organization whose job it is to manage people who the state's taken away their liberty interest. And so things like the appropriate standard for medical care delivery and the housing standards and similar kinds of things are issues that we're constantly bumping up against. So any movement particularly hard in any one of those directions bumps into these limitations in a fairly significant way, and I believe that's one of the reasons why people are challenged at times, even with a great desire to come in and sort of make massive restructuring of the corrections budget. It's these four sides of the box that become somewhat constraining and ultimately, I think, have to be part of the conversation. We did, as part of the recent cabinet, make a series of recommendations, and I think it's important to understand these recommendations. We had a limited time, and were asked to achieve a fairly significant standard. So we looked for things that were big system changes, changes that would, frankly, ignore some of the political challenges that might be incumbent on them when you consider them. And so recognizing, again, that you couldn't do all of them, because because if you do one, another one might not work. But the purpose was to provide essentially a menu of potential ideas and options for a legislature to consider as they're looking forward. And I want to comment on this point. These weren't really short-term strategies. The idea wasn't how do you get the budget to balance in 11-13. These strategies were really trying to look at this with a 10-year budgeting framework because particularly with respect to sentencing policies, it's very hard to do anything in the short term that is going to produce significant reductions unless you're talking about wide-scale early release of offenders. If you're talking about nuanced adjustments to sentencing policy, you see those downstream as you change a sentence from an 8-year sentence to a 5-year sentence. You wouldn't really see the financial impact of that until the beginning of the 6th year after that sentence for an individual who might be charged is served. So recognize that most of these recommendations really have downstream impacts, and that's where the savings is going to be. There aren't any real short-term solutions that provide the kind of look that we were asked to do in the reset cabinet. So obviously the first one here, craft the modern sentencing guideline system. You'll recall Oregon had sentencing guidelines in 89. They were ultimately, and still do at some level, but ultimately they were overcome with mandatory minimums once they were passed. But those sentencing guidelines in 89, which I think many agree didn't work particularly well, didn't work at some level because at that time Oregon had very, very few prison beds. We had gone through a long period of time with zero investment in our incarceration. The state had gotten larger, crime rates had expanded, we were in a system where we were literally running people in and out of as a new person came in under federal mandate, we were pushing somebody else back out the door through the parole board. Well, since then, we've built over 9,000 beds of additional prisons, and as a result of that construction, there's a lot more room to maneuver in a system, and a modern sentencing guideline system might be a way in which to utilize the total of the 14,000 plus beds we've got in operations in a more effective and efficient manner than we're currently using them. The second one, use the federal earn time model. We looked at this model. It had been recommended by some others who were critical of the way Oregon does earn time. Currently, it's a 20% earn time model. In 3508, there was an experimentation for certain offenders to go to 30%, and then that was pulled back. The feds use 15%, but it's important to also acknowledge that their 15% applies to virtually everyone in their system, except if you've got a life sentence. So murder, treason, things like that, you don't get it. Beyond that, virtually everybody in their system participates in their earn time model. But they also, equally important, have a system where they phase people out of their system within about a year of release or near a year of release and put them in, those who qualify, put them in halfway houses with enhanced electronic monitoring, and they save the cost of that prison bed by using a less expensive community supervision model at the end of a person's sentence. So we modeled what that might look like if we were to do that in Oregon. We modeled some selective adjustments to Measure 11, not wholesale repeal of Measure 11, but to look at certain categories of Measure 11 offenses that really drive a substantial part of the operation and to say, if you made modest adjustments to some of those sentences, what would the impact look like? Again, for purposes of just giving people a sense of the range of impacts and the challenges that you might consider. None of these obviously are without political consequences, but all of them we felt like were worthy of being modeled so we could at least have the conversation about what that might look like. We considered what the impact might be if there was a continuation of the suspension of Measure 57. That's perhaps the one item on the list that when you talk about a short-term strategy, it would have a short-term impact moving forward. As Measure 57, as the suspension expires, our current forecast assumes then that those beds start to come back online. Those offenders start to come back in the system, and it has an impact on our long-term forecast. If that suspension were continued, that forecast wouldn't come up at the same rate, and so we modeled that as well for purposes of the conversation. We looked at the creation of enhanced home detention models where you do some sort of a release within the last 12 months or 6 months, depending on how you want to do it, and giving the local supervisory authority enhanced supervision dollars, again, looking at things like enhanced electronic monitoring more than we currently do in Oregon. And we've developed, the Department of Corrections actually has developed a white paper on electronic monitoring that we'd be happy to share with the committee that sort of tells you a little bit about what's going on nationally, what the trends are. People think of electronic monitoring, and I think people think about the you remember the old movie Logan's Run, you know, where they had the you know, they had the chip kind of in their neck. It doesn't really work like that. There are GPS monitors that are out there, but that's the high end of electronic monitoring, and it's still very staff intensive at that level. But there is a whole range of electronic monitoring options based on what you're really trying to achieve and which group of offenders you're really trying to monitor. And so that's another place, I think, where we'll probably need to spend some time this session talking about if any of these options are considered. And then we also talked about some what I would consider to be pretty out-of-the-box ideas, incentive performance modeling with respect to public safety. Right now, as many of your community corrections constituents would probably tell you, we reward counties that are doing exceptionally well with their community corrections effort. If they're reducing recidivism and they're getting people off their caseload because they don't need to be supervised, we reward them currently under the state model by reducing their funding. So the reward of being really good at what you do in improving public safety is we give you less money. And there may be an economic disincentive sometimes for people to do the right thing because it hurts their organization as a result of it. And so one of the things we've talked about is there a means by which we actually can incentivize counties for using those resources well, getting excellent results, and investing in the kinds of programs that seem to be working for them. So that's one, and I would tell you that I think that's consistent not just in public safety, but throughout virtually all of state government. Anybody who's doing a good job and is reducing the caseload in the way we want it reduced is using resources, not gaining them. And so building some sort of an incentive or performance-based approach to this, I think, is something that we ought to be willing to talk about. We also talked about expanding community corrections, local control supervision from 12 to 24 months. Now, if you think about this, that can't be just 24 months sort of substituting the person in a jail bed versus a DOC bed, because there isn't going to be a lot of savings there. Under the current model, we use the DOC per diem rate to reimburse the counties. But if you give local supervisory authority like we do currently for the 12 months of community corrections local control for the full 24 months and let them manage that, so long as they've got access to jail beds to sanction the appropriate people, there might be a model there that both is a benefit to the community, is a benefit to the state, saves money, diverts people away from an expensive prison bed, and frankly allows you to use risk tools that may allow you to manage that person just as safely in that environment as you can manage them in the prison with no degradation of the community public safety. And then we also talked about the possibility of what would it look like if there was an incentive-based model for counties that use statewide approved charging guidelines. Again, in Mr. Prinz's presentation, he'll reference that while we've got sort of, in many cases, sort of standardized sentences, a lot of it depends on how individuals are charged. And the charging practices across the state are uniquely different from county to county. If you think about it in this way, those prison beds really are a resource that is ultimately determined by, on the front end of the criminal justice system, by local law enforcement and the counties on who they want to focus on and who they want to send to prison. And obviously there's a place that the court plays in that as well. But right now there's a disproportionate use of that statewide resource. And so the conversation that we played with, and again, got a lot of negative reaction, as you might imagine, from a lot of folks about, but nonetheless was, what if you created an incentive model where you incentivize counties who wanted to use a standard set of charging practices that would also allow us to better understand the use of this statewide resource and predict its use in a way that we have a hard time, I think, predicting in the current environment. We ran through a variety of we used the best information we had. We hired some folks that were funded not by the state, but by the folks from Pew to help us try to do some analysis of what the impacts of these would be. I want to make sure that you understand these are very broad estimates of what we think the impacts of this would be. And some of that is assuming forecasts over a decade that are difficult to predict, and the further out you get from the date the forecast is to the end of the decade, the less reliability you have. So I want to be really cautious that we're not overstating anything about these numbers. But we were asked again by Governor Kulongoski to try to put ranges on what we thought the impacts might be as part of the Public Safety Subcommittee on the reset report. So what you have here are ranges of numbers. These ranges reflect both how the law would be impacted and also our assessment of whether or not you're talking about a less expensive temporary bed where the DOC has used a crowding mechanism to put a bed up somewhere that's a less expensive bed, or a designated budgeted bed, and that range, obviously, of cost is different. So this just gives you some sense of what those ranges would be on the variety of issues that we looked at. And again, as I tell people, this is over a decade. So, you know, there aren't hundreds of millions of dollars, I think, to mine out of the corrections budget in a single biennium, but through strategies that you all might consider, there are ways to, over a decade, flatten that growth rate and consider the possibility of savings that could be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. I also talk about Measure 73, because as we're talking about all these strategies about how do we sort of adjust the trajectory downward, in November you're aware that Measure 73 was passed, which actually does just the opposite to our forecast. It actually bumps it up. It had the two parts that you remember. One is a sex offender part. If you've been convicted of a second major felony sex crime, you're sentenced to 25 years upon that second conviction. This one has a very small effect on the department in the short term. Most sex offense crimes have a pretty long sentence now. If they were coming in for a second one without this increased penalty, they would still be in for quite a long time on their second offense. So tacking on the longer sentence, really you don't see much impact on this until quite a ways into the decade for the department. But the DUII portion of Measure 73 does have a substantial impact, in part because of the way the law was written and a companion law that exists currently in Oregon statute, 813.012, which really makes these presumptive prison sentences given the crime. So it moves what was a presumptive probation sentence now to a presumptive prison sentence by statute, and that, even though the measure talked about 90 days, kicks that sentence into somewhere between a 13 to 30-month sentence. So here's the impacts. Very little impact on the sex crimes portion of the bill. On the DUII side, you can see the impacts. There were estimates done, conversations with prosecutors about how they would apply the measure. So somewhere between 250 to 330 beds, in addition to our current forecasted population in the 11-13 time frame. And then you can see that gets larger, obviously, in 15-17. So that's, again, another impact that we're going to have to try to address as we're talking about budgets moving forward in this biennium. There are two parts as well. One is what the impact would be from a bed count. The other thing is, you'll remember in 73, it did something that no other law in Oregon thus far has done, and that puts the state on the hook for the pretrial and post-trial incarceration at the county level. So this would be a certain category of crime that, if convicted of, the state would be responsible for paying for from the moment the person hits the front door of the jail through their trial, and then after their trial, if they stay in local control custody versus getting bumped up to the Department of Corrections, the state would still be on the hook for the actual cost of that. And there were some estimates done for the price tag committee that reflect what those costs are. So if we don't do anything moving forward, our projections are that we're going to grow over the next decade by about 2,400 beds. Giving these projections, we attempted to sort of show what those operational costs would be. We assume additional prison construction, some startup costs, the total debt service over the next decade being somewhere in the neighborhood of about $955 million, and again on a debt of about $1.6 billion that's currently outstanding from our investments thus far in prison construction moving forward. Back to this slide on the long-term budget. I threw this piece in. This sort of is to say, if you did everything that was contained in the reset report, if you took all of these individual actions, and you can see them reflected down in the box, that bottom dotted pink line still shows you where you would be. So you make a lot of headway by taking all of these steps, not just the public safety steps, but all the steps recommended in the report. You still end up about $1 billion or so short of where you need to be in order to bring the budget in balance across the decade. Another way to look at this is, if you didn't do anything with respect to the corrections budget, but you needed to take the share of this 20% shortfall out of public safety, this just reflects what would happen to the other agencies. You'd be talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of almost $100 million levels of cuts to the Youth Authority, to the State Police, and to community corrections, which we all know would clearly have a devastating effect on public safety on the front lines and in the community. So the message from this slide for me is really we all have to be in this together. We want a public safety system from the local law enforcement side all the way up through the State Department of Corrections to the release out for people to be managed under post-prison supervision. And we have to think about it systematically. And we can't overburden one particular portion of the system with reductions without having very negative consequences on the other part of the system. You can imagine as I present these and have presented them to a variety of groups and organizations in the last 6 to 8 months, no one does like these options, actually. When you lay them out, there's all sorts of reasons not to like virtually every one of these conversations. But my pitch to them is always, if you don't like these, then what do you have to suggest coming forward? With my budget particularly in corrections, there are really three major drivers that you have to think about. And the first one is, how big is the net that we want to have? How many and who do we want to put in prison? How long do we want them to stay? That's the second dial on the machine. And then the third one is, how much do we want to pay people for all of the supervisory and other services that we provide? And those three things collectively really drive the overall portion of the budget. There are smaller portions, obviously, on fuels and utilities and things like that that we continue to work very hard to minimize. But in the great percentage of our overall operation, it's these three things that really drive the major portion of the Department of Corrections budget. Significant long-term savings and cost avoidance will take time to achieve, as I mentioned, given the way it works. Obviously, you know better than anyone that the clock is ticking. I personally believe that immediate release approaches fail both operationally and politically, that's not the right strategy moving forward, that the right strategy is to really look at this in a long-term sort of way and develop a system from beginning to end that actually we can afford as a state and achieves our public safety purposes. And I think it's fair for us at this stage of the game. I mean, I think we've had a system unlike many states, and we've looked at a number, and during this process, we looked at a number of states, Texas and Kansas and Tennessee and Kentucky and other states that are going through this very same problem and what they're trying to do to address it. And unlike most of those states where their legislature has sort of built their model over time, Oregon is a unique state, maybe closely most resembling California with respect to the fact that much of its criminal justice policy has been established through the initiative process. And so the question that I think it's fair to pose, and I don't think that it's heresy to pose it, is do we believe that we've really got it right? I mean, is that the way, if we were all sitting down today to design a new model, would we use all the same elements that we currently have, or would we think a little more strategically about what kinds of resources we have available, what resources can we afford, and how do we want to employ them? Are we using all the best evidence? Are we sure we've got the structure right? Are we sure we've got the length right? Are we targeting the right group of offenders? Are we using risk tools that are available now that weren't available 10 or 15 years ago to really help us best understand our choices? And then are we making the right sort of resource allocation as we move forward? So, Mr. Chair, I believe that this is the beginning of what's going to obviously have to be a much longer conversation moving forward through this biennium in this legislative session about these issues. But I, you know, hopefully that begins a framework for a discussion we hope to have. And I will tell you that, you know, we're committed, obviously, at the department to provide the committee, the policymakers, all the resources that we can as you're having to sort of wade through these options and consider what alternatives would be coming forward.
Max, thank you very much. I have about 9:25. So, Craig, how much time do you need for your presentation?
Mr. Chair, we can do it in 30, 40 minutes. It probably we could use longer, too. It's up to you.
So what I want to do here is people probably have some questions for the director,
yeah.
And so I'm thinking we're going to do that, and I think we're going to come look at what our schedule is because I don't want to cut it short.
Sounds good.
So why don't you hang tight. Questions for Max. Go ahead.
Thank you. I think Max, Director Williams, you've done a really good job in laying this out. One thing that I would like to see the Department of Correction flesh out a little more. In Oregon, it costs about $85 a night to incarcerate a person. In Idaho, about $62 a night. In Texas, about $46 a night. and I'm just sitting here doodling with numbers. If with 14,000 inmates, 365 days a year, costs about 800 times two, you know, for the biennium, costs about $850 million to incarcerate 14,000 people in Oregon, and don't hold me to those numbers, but just in the ballpark. In Texas, incarcerating the same number of people would cost $460 million, which is $390 million less. In Idaho, it would cost about $310 million or $620 million, which is $230 million less. And so you talked about your cost drivers, but has the department examined the differences in those in the states from those that cost the most to those that cost the less, and broken them down by the cost drivers to see what is driving the difference? Is it labor costs? Is it constitutional mandates? I mean, can you break that down for us so that we know what we need to address to save the money, where the money is?
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, we've looked obviously at cost per day numbers a lot. The first thing I'll do is I'll give a cautionary statement, because I think in all the groups and organizations that I am involved in with nationally with corrections agencies, whether it's the National Institute of Corrections, whether it's the Association of State Correctional Administrators, there isn't a uniform model for counting what's included in a cost per day on a state-to-state basis. So the first thing I always say, and we use these comparisons a lot, so the first thing I always say is I'm not always sure what's in everybody's denominator, so I'm always a little nervous about making too much out of comparisons from one state to the next. That being said, I think it is fair to say that there are differences, and they're driven by, I think, the two issues that I talked about, and they're as primary drivers, and they're not disconnected. One is our sentencing policy has grown the number of prisons that we operate, which means we've built new prisons, and then we've employed additional people to supervise this population. So the agency's grown. We probably, in the last 15 years, we probably doubled the size of the agency, both in the number of inmates who are being supervised and in the total number of staff that it takes to actually run and supervise them. So you've had a fairly substantial growth in total number of employees, like you have in the total number of inmates. I think another distinction between states like Idaho and Texas is they approach their approach to public employees differently. I'll put this on the record. This was a conversation I intended to have probably more individually with each of you. But you know, you can unitize corrections costs fairly easily. The unitized cost of a cost per inmate per day is one that, you know, is my daily sort of conversation with almost everybody about this number, because it is a unitizable cost in a way that is different, I think, than a lot of other costs. I don't very often hear of people trying to unitize the cost of other functions of state government. And I would tell you that I think if you were to compare our unitized cost and our out-of-sync difference with a state like Idaho or Texas and compare it to another function of state government that you could unitize, you would find that we wouldn't be dramatically out of step. You know, we're subject to, for example, PERS obligations that are, as you all know, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, fairly substantial impact on the budget going forward, and that is built into our base. And those kinds of things drive our per unit cost, because we are a people business, and we have great staff. And I don't want any of my comments to be misconstrued as any kind of a complaint about the quality of people that we have working for us. And in fact, I'll give you a testimonial. I had folks visiting from another state in the Midwest that I won't name, but when they walked through our institutions, they said two things that were the most remarkable to them is they were actually looking at how we handle the inmates and our Oregon accountability model for how we manage to focus on reentry from the time they walk in the door. These people said two things. They remarked how impressed they were with the cleanliness of our institutions, how clean our prisons were. And the second thing they commented on was they were impressed with how our staff were engaging the inmates in a pro-social way. that they were working with the inmates, that it wasn't an us versus them sort of mentality inside those institutions. And they didn't see that in the state they were from. And I got to tell you, I know what those people pay for the staff in that state, because we've had those conversations, and you get what you pay for at a certain level. And so, you know, I'll defend the staff of the Oregon Department of Corrections. They do tremendous work. But there is no question that our compensation structure and our benefit structure and our retirement structure, which isn't just the Department of Corrections, you know, we're just a piece of that model. It's the entire state. That does play a part in why that per unit cost is higher than a state like Idaho or a state like Texas. But I would tell you that given what we get and the product we get at the end of the day, I think we get what we pay for.
Let me interject. Since Texas has come up, since that's my birth state, and I actually had the opportunity when I was an undergrad to go through the process of looking at the Texas Department of Corrections. At that time, which was the late 70s, they only had like 17 prison facilities at the time. And I was really impressed on the number of programs they had that really cut their costs, because they had an institution that basically paid for itself to the point of where they were paying like the cost per inmate was like $7, $8 per day. But they ran their own farms, ranches, they made their own mattresses, they had all their leather work, the shoes, everything like that was being done. Plus, as I think what the director is also saying, is that it is a right to work state, so you didn't have, at least I think it probably still is, as to how those salaries are actually determined. And you look at the quality of the individuals that were having those jobs as compared to what I think we see in the sense of the approach we've taken. It's just a different philosophy. And
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And, you know, we used to run prison farms in Oregon, and they actually became cost prohibitive. I mean, you could buy, you know, the cost of running the farm was at some point, and this was before my tenure, got to the point where it was more expensive to run the farm than it was to buy the, you know, the large product on the commodity. I think still some of the states in the South that have particularly low cost per inmate per day continue to operate sort of large scale sort of corporate farming operations that help reduce their costs. But they also, I think, for the most part, are right to work states. And so I think it is a combination of those differences that have an impact. So we have broken down cost per day to a very sort of, now that $86 per day is a spectrum cost across the entire department. So I have institutions that run much less than that because they're low custody inmates that need very little in the way of services, and they're doing outside work crew. And then I have institutions where I've got large infirmaries with sick people who cost a lot more than that. So that's an average cost. But we can break that number down for you. We can show you the components of each of the elements that builds into that, and we'd be happy to do that with you at any point if the committee's interested.
I want to follow up just a second, if I could.
Yes.
The growth of the prison population in Oregon, I don't believe is valid in a comparison with the other states. It may be it's valid in the growth of the Oregon budget, but Oregon doesn't incarcerate more people per capita than these other states do.
Mr. Chair,
100%, you know, so the, you know, you have to kind of leave that out and say, why is it that our cost per individual, our unit cost, is so different? Are we comparing apples and apples or apples and oranges? And if we're comparing apples and apples, then why is our cost more? And what I was asking for is, can you break that down? And you said you probably could.
Sure.
Let's break that down into what are the cost drivers that separate Oregon and Texas. Oregon, I think Texas now has, I think, this is off the top of my head, but I think 32 or 34 prisons.
They had 130 as of about 5 years ago.
Yeah,
exponentially, it's just amazing what
they're the top three as far as size of the systems.
And everything used to be in basically East Texas and south, right south of Houston, but then they went across the board, and they've had a lot of massive buildup in the late 90s.
Yeah, they incarcerate 202,000 people now. That was in 2009. That's not the reason report.
Yep.
But I mean, it's just a stark change. I mean, difference.
2-1.
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, I agree with you. If you look at our total percentage of incarceration, rate of incarceration, I think what these numbers are trying to show is not necessarily the per capita rate of incarceration, but the rate by which we grew that has increased our cost. Oregon went through a long period of time where we didn't invest anything in corrections, and then we hit sort of the beginning of the 90s, and then with the passage of Measure 11, where the investment was required, and we grew then very quickly. And so there is a difference, and I agree with you, Senator, between the per capita rate of incarceration and the rate of growth of incarceration that we've had in the state during that period of time.
Thank you. I just have a quick question about the federal earn time. Do you happen to know how many, if any, other states have adopted that federal model?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, there was a recent sort of review of all the states that do earn time policies, and I'd be happy to share that with you. I think every state has a little bit of a different twist on earn time. I'm not sure that I could say on the record that there is a state who's adopted the federal model, but I can tell you that the range of states and how they use earn time is really sort of all over the map. Some that still use an old good time system that really isn't earn time like ours, others that grant additional earn time along with sort of a base amount for particular things like getting your GED or working in a particular job, or in some states, for example, where like we do, they use fire crews. Oregon doesn't do this, but other states do. You get sort of, you know, an extra 3 days for every day you're out fighting a fire. And, you know, there's just a whole range of different approaches. But we're happy to share that information with you. And again, the problem with all these state-to-state comparisons, as you know, is that it's very difficult sometimes to figure out exactly how everybody's counting, what they're counting, and sort of making the comparison. But we'll give you the best information we've got.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Mr. Chair, thank you, Max, for your presentation. It's helpful, and I had a similar question about the federal earned time, but I am going to ask you, and it seems like every time you're up here, I ask you about Wapato.
Oh,
because
thank you, Senator.
See the slide up there that says new prisons, we've had a jail sitting in my community for 8 years, is it 10 years? I've lost track, that we paid for, has been built, and has been empty, and I know you were working with Chair Wheeler. Now we have a new chair. If you could educate the community on what the latest status is, because that's a facility that we've been trying to see if we can get corrections to work with the county so we don't have to build new prison beds because we've got some available.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dingfelder, we continue to engage the county in conversations about Wapato. We issued a report during the last session that sort of laid out the analysis. It's not particularly well suited. We have a prison just up the road from Wapato called the Columbia River Correctional Institution, right out there by the airport, that provides sort of the release services we need for the DOC population that's releasing out into the community. So it's not particularly well suited to our needs, but we've done lots of analysis around it. We continue to have conversations with the county. Recently, as you may remember, we closed a small minimum custody facility here in Salem, Oregon State Penitentiary Minimum. So we're at a point right now, given sort of our use of temporary emergency beds and our ability to close OSP Minimum, that we're not needing, as of today, to go down that road. If we do need to go down that road with new prison construction, if policy choices aren't made, I have every belief that we will revisit the Wapato conversation in a meaningful way with the county and with the legislature. But again, I think it's, you know, first and foremost, it's not particularly well suited to our needs. The county made some effort to have some of the conditioning stuff made different with the Portland County or with the Portland City folks, and we'll
be happy to come by and talk to you about what those impacts were and how that looks. My hope is, my intent would be, that we neither need Wapato nor do we need to go forward with any kind of a request to actually move forward with the construction of Junction City. The presentation I'm putting forward here today is really an invitation for us to think differently about how we're doing this business and to try to divert people with existing structures and policies away from the front door of the prison so we can utilize these very, very expensive resources, the most expensive tool in your public safety toolbox, in a way that's more efficient. So if I had my wish, Senator, it would be that Wapato always stands empty as sort of a symbol of a facility that we don't need because we've changed our policies. We've gotten jails and prisons because we can manage people better at a time when crime rates are at a 40-year low. That's a success message in my mind.
I appreciate that, and I have absolutely the same goals. One of the things, our job is to not send you more people to go to prison, is to keep people out of prison, but we do have that facility, and if we have to deal with ballot measure 57, which, if we can't postpone that, as you mentioned before, that's also another opportunity because those beds were specifically built to work with people that had addiction issues.
Let me change that.
Anyway, we can talk more.
Yeah, let me change the focus. I mean, under the proposal, if we actually made some modifications as to the community corrections and expanding from 12 months to 24 months, is it your opinion, based on what you know of that facility, it could be used by the county and their management of the individuals that would be staying within their jurisdiction instead of coming to the state system?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I'm always, I'm just going to put a word of caution here. I try really hard to not tell local governments how I think they ought to manage their jail operations and their facilities. So I can't go on the record and tell you that I think they could use it for that purpose because they'll have their own assessment of whether that's done. I do think if we were to go down a path that allowed for a greater degree of local control population in sanctioned beds, particularly tied to, as Senator Dingfelder said, short-term stays of the right kind of offender tied to some kind of a treatment model, that could in fact work. And not just for that county, but for the neighboring counties in the Tri-County area. And I guess this is what I'd put back on the table. We build these structures that are sort of insular, and I think part of what we have to start talking about is how do we use all of our public safety resources as a system as opposed to just let them be divided by the fact that you can throw a rock across the county line and it's a whole different group of people who are responsible for that offender, even if they live closer in proximity to where the person's standing because of this artificial boundary we've created that then creates a barrier to service. And again, that's not just an issue, I think, for corrections. That's an issue for the way we deal with health care. That's an issue for the way we deal with mental health services. And I think we got to figure out strategies that get us over those kinds of limitations.
Okay. If there's no other questions, I want to do is thank you, Mayor.
Thank
for
you
being
very
here
much
very
for the
much.
Opportunity.
Craig, why don't you come on up? And what I'd like to do is get Craig's presentation going. He is going to be back here tomorrow on another bill. What I'd like to do is see if we can't maybe get his presentation and necessarily hold the questions, or people want to stay. I'm not sure what your schedules are.
Yeah,
right. I understand.
So this is the presentation that we did have, correct?
Mm-hmm. So at least we'll get started on this, and then we can resume tomorrow.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'd be glad to get started. I think, and then we can. I'll be here tomorrow, and I can go over it. So I don't mind if you ask questions or don't. It's totally up to the committee and to the chair. My name is Craig Prinz. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. I worked with Director Williams on the reset that Governor Kulongoski started, and I wanted to make a presentation that kind of dovetailed with what Max said and talk a little bit more in depth about sentencing structure in Oregon, crime. I have some interesting polling on public perceptions on public safety. What do voters really care about? What resonates with them? And then the last two things on my summary here are two tools that we think will be helpful to the system and to you as the policymakers in deciding, you know, what's the best return on your investment for public safety? How do you identify which offenders, for example, would be best to keep in a community setting rather than in an incarceration setting?
All right, so I think what we're going to do is you're going to start your presentation. We'll go section to section. If you have questions, just go ahead and just interject those.
That's great.
That way we can take those and close those off, and then we'll just pick up where, tomorrow where we leave off.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think Max hit this focused on Oregon, and this focuses on Oregon, that we do have are at a 40-year low measured by the FBI Uniform Crime Reports. That is a national trend. I think I spoke to many of you during the interim about this trend. It's a over a decade. It's violent crime and property crime, and it's national. So if you looked at a longer-term look at crime rates, basically they started going up in the 70s and 80s and began going down in the late 80s and 90s, and that's throughout the country. And so we have to keep that in mind. Remember that part of this is incarceration, it's demographics, it's the new policing techniques we have, it's new technologies we have. Part of it, to be very clear, we don't know why crime makes these cyclical changes. You've probably read, there's articles I've seen in the newspaper the last 6 months, it could be more trees planted in cities was one of them. I won't take credit for that one. Lead paint actually has a little bit more, I think, statistical look at it. Lead paint is shown to reduce IQ of infants. And so as the country and the Western world basically stopped using lead paint, they think that meant there were fewer kids with low IQ. Low IQ in an infant is related to future criminal behavior. So, but this is a national long-term trend. And the third bullet point is probably just as important, which is that doesn't mean Oregon citizens think they're as safe today as they were in the 60s. That's what the FBI says. That's what the National Victimization Survey say. That is not what their cable TV tells them about the world outside their home. Their TV says that the world outside is meaner today than it was, and I think that has a lot to do with the way media has covered crime and how much access we have to information around the world. We know more about what's going on in Egypt today than we probably do about our neighbor because of the way our society is set up at this point.
So the way I want to do this is go ahead and dialogue.
Okay, very good. Craig, first of all, just a comment. I think that that we probably shouldn't go to places like trees and lead paint and so forth unless you have a statistical confidence analysis, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Witz, I completely agree. I was just pointing out there are so many efforts at explaining some of this crime drop that I think just we should acknowledge with some humility that we do what we can do. But when you look at something that's national and this long term, I would be the first one to say the criminologists in the 90s and 80s were not predicting this. They missed this. They did not see that we were going to all go in this long crime drop. And so I was just pointing that out kind of facetiously that you've seen some pretty out there explanations for why this is, and I will not be giving a bill about tree planting or lead paint concession.
There's a couple of things that in talking with some of the sheriffs in the area that I represent, they believe that part of this trend may be a difference in how it's reported.
They do.
Sometimes some folks report any crime that is committed.
Right.
Some folks commit any crime that is prosecuted.
Right.
Some people,
right.
And any crime that is convicted. There's a huge change in that curve. And then the other thing I'd like you to comment on is the trend in, say, the last year or the last 18 months since we've had this many people coming off of unemployment, families breaking apart and so forth, that if we've seen a significant change in the last 18 months.
All right, great questions, Mr. Chair, Senator Witsit. So first of all, I have the same conversations with the sheriffs. Any data you look at, first of all, we look at several streams of data. We looked at the victimization surveys. That shows that actually people report more crime nationally than they did 10, 15 years ago. That shows that when you do a household survey and you ask, have you been a victim of crime, that shows crime is going down. The FBI UCR Center, you're correct, it relies on offenses made known to law enforcement, so the citizen would have to tell law enforcement in some way that they were a victim of crime, and that could be a theft, it could be a murder. What we do is we track that. We track, specifically, we track crimes that we know are going to be reported. For example, a break into a car where, for insurance purposes, you're going to report that. That is descending. We track homicide because we know those are pretty much all made known to law enforcement. That's descending. So we look at this very carefully. I know that the sheriffs are concerned about that, and there might be some level of that. And there's always crime that does not go reported. That's definitely true. But when we look at all the statistics show that there is a real crime drop, and it's not just a change in reporting. To answer your question about unemployment, unemployment itself has not been linked to higher crime. If there's a very small link. What gets more concerning in say Josephine County, where I'm from, or Klamath, or the several counties in the southern part of the state that you represent, it's when you get into a place where there's poverty, there's hopelessness, where there's not opportunities. That's the long-term concern, and so we have very, very thankfully, the crime rates are still trending down, and we have, the most update we had was 2009 for the whole state. We can look at 2010, the first 6 months, for the bigger cities, and we can see overall it's still trending down. Some are going up, some are going down, but if you look at the big cities, we still see a positive trend. Poverty is a concern. I mean, and that I think we're used to seeing it in an urban setting, but I think it's just as big as a concern. And it's really, I think unemployment for a year or 6 months isn't going to make a plumber become a robber, but it's that generational hopelessness that begins to really be the bigger concern, is what I would say. And we're tracking that very carefully on the local crime rates.
Thank you.
This, I think, goes also to Senator Whitsitt's question a little bit. So to be very clear, Oregon is very average in America as to how we incarcerate. If you just look at how many Oregonians per 10,000 are in a prison setting, we're 28th out of the 50 states. So it's very true to say we are not a big incarcerator when you compare to other states. That being said, we all know we've been under this experiment of incarceration our whole country. And so we have tripled our incarceration, meaning there's three times as many Oregonians per 10,000 in a prison setting as there were in 1980 today, while the nation has quadrupled. Part of Senator Whitsitt's, I think I heard part of the dialogue with Director Williams. We've grown later. We grew mostly in the 90s. While and Director Williams talked about how in the 80s we really didn't grow our system very much when we had that crime spike. That means that our growth has been more recent. I think that I've looked at it very briefly. I know that means we carry more debt service, for example, per bed than some states. So I know that might be part of what Director Williams will hopefully be able to take apart for you and look at by category. And of course, we're looking at then the future with Measure 73 and Measure 57 would come online back in January 2012. Maybe that we can just hit this slide and that I'll try to do it briefly and then we can answer questions. The blue is the actual forecast, or the actual number of offenders in a bed, which is right around 14,000 right now. You can see it did go down from the legislative actions from last session there at the very end. The green line would be the forecast with Measure 73, and this would be showing the presumptive prison sentence that Max mentioned, that the way Measure 73 was meant, was written, where it says it classifies a DUI as a C felony. That means the presumptive sentence, because of statutes that were passed in 1999, will be a prison sentence. And the courts will look at the language that says this is a Class C felony and the minimum is 90 days jail. They will see the 90 days jail as a minimum, but the presumptive sentence would be prison. And we worked with our stakeholders. We had a public hearing. We asked the members from the Oregon District Attorneys Association and the judicial branch. How are you going to apply this? And that's how we informed that they're not going to send everyone to prison, but they're going to send, you know, they said they would be seeking to send more than half to prison. So that's what informed that. The brown line is the October forecast. That would be with the Measure 57 numbers. The important thing about that brown line is when our office did an estimate without any information about how district attorneys and judges would apply it in the counties, which is always the hardest part to try to figure out, is how will the new law change how the law is applied. We thought that it would be 1,600 beds due to Measure 57. We then had a year of experience with Measure 57 before it was turned off, for lack of a better word, and we now have revised that to a 1,000-bed estimate. So the brown line shows a 1,000-bed estimate. That's Measure 57. If it comes back and is applied the way it was in that 2009 window. And then the red line would be more reflective, I think, of the assumptions in Governor Kitzhaber's budget, where there's an assumption that Measure 57 would be suspended and that the portion of the DUII would be tweaked so that there's not a presumptive sentence of prison, but it would be a 90-day jail bed. In other words, there wouldn't be an impact to bed need for Max Williams and the department, but the state would have to pay for the local jail, the language is the actual cost of incarceration.
Okay, so questions, and I think this would be a break point, and questions. All right. So why don't we make this a break, and I guess I'm looking at the schedule for tomorrow. Drew's brought it forward. It looks like it's pretty straightforward. Bills for the state police and then the parole board. So I think we can stay on. How much more time do you think you need, Matt? Okay, then let's go ahead and we'll stay on at 8:30 start. I was thinking we could actually start this up earlier, but I'm confident that we have enough time for the other four bills that will move pretty quick. So we'll adjourn for today, continuing first thing in the morning with Mr. Prince's continuation of the presentation. And if there are any possible methods for introduction, then we'll get into the public hearings on the other bills. Anything else? Thank you very much.